meet him, ran to meet him while he was running to meet his dad. They were running to meet each other. To me, that's an expression of unity. And that's the physical sense, but there's the mental sense. The mental sense is when we can mentally agree to bring something into physical existence while it's only in spiritual existence. That's how mental strength works, is that we can put our physical energies together to create something. My personal opinion of, to answer Sydney, now I quit getting sidetracked, is that to me the Land Claims Bill was created for all the people that are here now and are yet to come, for all the Native people. So I feel in this sense that, yes, we need to make sure that the people born after 1971 are part of Gunaiu in this area. And as far as the stock, I don't think that we should sell something when we don't know what we have. Not yet, anyway. Maybe not ever. I heard somebody say that they didn't think the stock should ever be sold. Well, I really haven't thought about that. But as far as selling the stock now, I don't think we're ready to sell the stock. If a person had something to sell personally, that they own personally, they wouldn't be ready to sell it unless they had decided collectively. I mean, he had to decide within himself. He's an entity by himself. He's a community by himself. If it was man and wife, they have to both decide to sell something. If they disagree, they can't sell it because they disagree. In order to live together, they have to agree. And up to now, on December 18, 1971, that's when the Land Claims Bill was signed, we're saying 20 years forward, okay? In order to get the money part of the Land Claims Bill, it took at least 5 years. In order to get the land part of the Land Claims Bill, that even hasn't been accomplished yet, and it's 14 years ago. It's 13 years ago, going on 14 now. And they still haven't accomplished the changing title, ownership of the land. So how can we sell something when we still don't even have it even? And even if we got it, like as far as Gunaiu is concerned, that's 684 square miles of land, we don't know what's on that land. We still don't know what's on that land. We haven't even hardly started to find out because we're busy trying to file for the conveyance to get the land. So even if we're going to sell it, I think 1991 is too soon, because I think we'd be selling something that we don't know what we have, and therefore we'd be further putting ourselves down the road for failure, because we'd be giving away something. We might sell something and not realize the full value of what's in it before we sell it, so not put on the right price. And while that might be for stock, that's also for land, because the stock is, at this point, is part of the land. And then as far as the land goes, while I was talking about selling the land, again, my personal opinion is that I don't think we should sell any land. I don't think we should even sell 1 inch. I think we should buy whatever we can buy and trade for whatever we can trade for, but come out on the long end all the time as far as land is concerned, and just keep building on land. Because I think land has a totally infinite value. I don't think you can ever establish value on land. The best value you can ever establish is the land right here, 1 minute, right now. Now the next minute in the future, that value is already obsolete because the world is increasing in population all the time and never in land base. And so I don't think that we should ever sell the land. I've been told, in trying to make a decision on what to do about land, it's very simple, very, very simple. Sell the grass and keep the land. And you can sell the grass every season, and as the grass gets more valuable, you still own the land, you keep selling the grass. And as far as, just to help you envision what the value of land might be, And I don't think anybody can really say what it might be. You know, you can, the price that the city sold land for when it first became a first-class city and people needed land to get reestablished after the 1971 flood, the land was trading for 3 cents a square foot for residential land and 5 cents a square foot for commercial land. And so a lot that was 20,000 square feet, half an acre about, sold for $600. And that was in 1974. And in March, the city of Galena had a land sale.
In March this year?
Mm-hmm. March of 1984, the city had a competitive land sale, a sealed bid. And a 20,000 square foot lot, I believe on the average, sold for about $7,500. So that's quite a large increase in a matter of 10 years. You know, so where's the future going to take us? That's my personal opinion. Does that answer your question, Sidney? I didn't mean to. I didn't want you to think I was sidestepping it, and I figured if I was going to, I better get back up here and answer it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hundorf. I wonder if any of the people from out of town want to speak this afternoon. Maybe we should hear from you pretty soon. If you have a question, maybe you could use my microphone or this one, and then we'll try this one. Go ahead.
Up here. I want to know who created this situation here in Galena. Something we never had before. Turn down. Why is it our children who graduate from school ready to build their own cabin like their parents did? Impossible. Impossible. Because people moved here and built a city here on our tribal land without being asked or even bothered to ask. Then creating out of nothing, then measuring out lots, demanding $7,000 minimum for each lot. You know of any kid got $7,000 in his pocket when he come out of school that can go out there and buy a lot from you fellas that you don't own? That's what I don't see is right. That's off altogether. You're just putting them kids back to nothing, that they ain't worth nothing. The kids are worth a heck of a lot to us parents. And we want to see them have a start. They're supposed to have a start right here. Alan Oller done that. He wanted the people, his generations behind him, to be able to build right there, right, open the door and go out and start building. That was not for people to come in there and claim. That's why he was so far ahead of us. He had me mark out the land and put in claim with the federal government. The kids have no chance at all. That's absolutely wrong. Somebody planned that, not me.
Thank you, sir. Our next witness is Mr. Fred Huntington. Perhaps after Mr. Fred Huntington, some of you people from out of town might come forward, just in case you have to get a plane home a little later today. Maybe we could proceed in that way. Carry on, Mr. Huntington.
First of all, I'd like to say, answer one of the questions I was asked is that, do you want to sell your stock? Well, there's also your land with your holdings, with your each individual estate belongs to each individual, and that he has a right to transact his property as he see, whether it's voluntarily or involuntary. You could lose it, or you could work with it. You lose it by bad debts. You owe the state money, you owe the bank money or some, you know, and then your stock taken away or your land taken away from you as an individual. And when you have generations behind you coming up, you don't have it. When the land claims was passed, that's the law that was passed. You could either make the best of what you got or lose it through involuntary acts. There's a lot of different ways you can lose your property. And once you lose your stock, that means that that part of you from your corporation is separated. You're no longer a shareholder, and you have, once you sell your stock, then you have, maybe you have a native allotment over there on the side. And you figure, well, shucks, I need some money, I'll sell a little bit of it, you know. I'll sell a little bit more, and I'll sell. Pretty soon, you're on the street, and you're broke again. You don't have your stock. You don't have your native allotment. You don't have your town site lot. And the government will quit giving you welfare, and where will you go after that? You know, that's one way to look at it. But if every individual look at it as one in a group to protect the other, then I'd say, well, you know, well, run it through the corporation. Will the corporation buy back our stock what we lost? That's spinning the wheels for nothing again. You have to be aware of what that piece of paper means when you sign your name to it. It's your stock. Each individual is an individual, and nobody can tell you what to do or where to go. It's you that's doing it to yourself, and you can make the best of it. So there's ways that you do lose your stock involuntarily. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Huntington. Mr. Huntington reminds me of a point that perhaps is worth bearing in mind, and that is that a corporation, just like any other business entity, if it piles up enough bad debts, could lose its land to a creditor, or could be forced into bankruptcy and its assets, including its land, sold to outsiders. I don't think that's happened to any native corporation in Alaska, but it's something that can happen to any native corporation, including native corporations. Well, did some of you from out of town want to say something at this stage?
My name is Peter Demoski. I'm from Nolato. I don't claim to represent Nolato. This commission is looking for personal opinions about the Land Claims Act, and that's strictly what I'm here for. I want to get back to something Roger Huntington said previously. I've sat on the Sieberling Udall Commission 8-9 years ago, and I can agree with Roger. You sit through hours of those commission meetings. A year later, they give you a book about this thick of all the comments compiled, and nothing really comes of them. Those are congressional commission meetings. Mr. Gerber here is looking for opinions to help him set up a Land Claims Act in Canada. So he isn't promising us any results from these meetings, which is good, because I probably wouldn't accept them as truth anyway. I want to address a couple of questions that Mr. Gerber brought up. He asked Mr. Hundorf, I'll get your name. He asked Mr. Hundorf if a corporation is successful, the Gunayu. I don't believe you can really ask that question in total context. I don't care if a corporation makes millions of dollars for its stockholders. if you don't pay attention to your constituents, stockholders, you're not really successful. You're looking at the social well-being, which hasn't been successful in any corporation. Gunna U, for example, I'll just use that because that's our native corporation. Now, when we're talking about money, or another question he brought up was experience. You have 12 years experience. I hope you're not addressing all the stockholders in the corporation. You're talking about a limited few. Like Sydney said, 80-90% of the people don't know what the corporation is, what it does, what it's supposed to be doing. So none of us have experience. You're just talking about a select few. Okay. By the way, I understand you're going to be using our commons to help you base your Land Claims Act in Canada, right?
Well, let me make this clear. I think Mr. Huntingdon, Roger Huntingdon, thought that I was here representing the federal government. I'm not. I've been asked to come by Native Peoples organizations, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council of Indigenous People. But the first purpose of my being here is to enable me to write a report about ANCSA for Alaska Natives. That is a report that you can make use of. I hope you can make use of. It will also be made use of by Native peoples in Canada, Greenland, Australia, and I think the lower 48 as well, because what happened here in 1971 is in a sense unique. Your settlement is unique. There's no other settlement like it in the lower 48 or any other country. And so my first purpose is, because I was asked to come, to write a report that you can use and that Native people in other countries can use. I hope that we can do that job. When I said I wanted your experience, really what I wanted to know was, has ANCSA made a difference in your life? What has the establishment of the Native corporations done for you, if it has done something for you? I'd like to hear about it. If it hasn't done anything for you, I'd like to hear that too. If I'd like to know how you feel about the issue that Mr. Huntingdon raised with Mr. Hundorf, sale of shares in 1991. All of these questions. I appreciate that only a few people have had experience running the Native corporations. I understand that. I hope I have answered your question.
Okay, yeah.
I'm answering questions the way Mr. Hundorf does.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, I'll just assume then that with this information, you'll be helping other Native groups, Canada or United States, come up with a similar Land Claims Act. Has anyone advised you don't even pursue it?
Well, quite a few. We held hearings at Anchorage to start this off, and we had some of the leaders from 1971, Native leaders from 1971 came. John Borbridge Jr., Charlie Edwardson, Charlie Johnson, the current president of AFN, Byron Malott, the president of Sea Alaska, and I can tell you that I can't sum up all of their evidence, but Charlie Edwardson, for instance, said that the Canadians and the Greenlanders and the Australians, the native people in those countries, shouldn't follow the ANCSA model. So that I've heard that before. If that's your view, I'd like that on the record too.
Yeah, well, you've heard comments from other people here that we started these corporations overburdened with problems that we didn't consider. And that's why I wouldn't advise another Native group, you know, use the same Alaska ANCSA as a base for their Land Claims Act. Now, getting back to the corporations as a success or not, and then getting up to the 1991 problem.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't consider 1991 problem a major issue at this time. If it was ever going to be a major issue, it should have come out in 1971 when the corporation first started. 13 years later is a little late to be taking it and trying to work out problems that'll happen in 7 years. You just never do it. 1991 will be in the same situation as we are now. I don't see any recourse for improvement. Unless someone disagrees with me, you're welcome. The biggest problem I see with the corporations when it was passed was the lack of searching for people to run these corporations. By law, you have to be a native stockholder. We're all aware that there were no natives capable of finance, management, or any of those things to run a corporation. Now, if I was going to advise you, I'd look for that talent first and make sure you have a bank of talent ready as years go on. Right now, we're stuck with the same leaders we had in 1971. I don't see no new group of native leaders to succeed them. If we do fail as corporations, that'll be the main reason, lack of native-born talent. Other than that, that's about all I have to say. Okay.
Thanks very much.
There would be no chance at all for the native to come back to tribal land.
Well, that's a view that people have expressed, Mr. Evans, and I've heard it in other places I've been. Mr. Evans said, will there be a chance for Native people to go back to tribal government and not have corporations? I said, well, that's a view that has come up at some places I've been. Other places people have said, well, maybe we could combine the advantages of tribal government and the corporation. So I want to hear all points of view. I think
naturally, corporation individuals, what they're doing, they have to get the vote from the whole tribe. Cape River people already have votes to be told. And then this matter.
Well, maybe we could hear from you.
Nobody ever has to have a word, you know, they just formed a corporation or a corporation.
Well, we're not. Yeah. Well, maybe we could hear from Mr. Switzer and then carry on with further comments from others and from yourself. Yes.
My name is Pat Switzer. I'm Vice President of Lands for the Corporation and a shareholder in Gunayu Limited. And Gunayu Limited is a consolidation. And I emphasize consolidation for Max's sake of the former village corporations of Nulato, Kaikuk, and Glena. And Caltech. I kind of read about your commission, and I'm glad that you were able to come here to listen to our story. You've heard from several people already that have talked about commissions that have been by here in the past, so these old walls have heard quite a few words. They've witnessed lots of occasions, weddings and dances and wakes and potlatches, a few church services, name a few, and these walls have heard a lot of songs and laughter, tears, some wise words, maybe a few scoldings from some elders or something, you know, but they've heard it all. I've been told that you, Mr. Berger, are an impeccable man, maybe way up there in terms of your opinions and your credibility and your sincerity and humbleness. I've been told that the eyes of the world are, eyes and ears of the world are watching these hearings. And the embodiment of the commission that you represent. I've also been told that you're a focal point for the indigenous people of North America, and yea, even an influence on the world, other indigenous people of the world. On level of hearings, that these walls occurred, I can't compare anything to the significance of your commission here, even though you're unattached to the, our government. In terms of comparative significance of this hearing, I kind of liken it to the meeting between Judge Wickersham and the Tanna chiefs in the early part of the century. The only changes are the time and the players and the situation. For the sake of yourself and those assembled here, I always like to give my definition of significant. Significant isn't like carrot or turnip or somewhere in your mind's eye you can visualize what it means. Significant means important. Significant means full of meaning. Significant means momentous. And that's exactly what the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was and is. If we were to compare in a historical perspective, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I would compare myself to at the time of Andrew Jackson. Because during the time of Andrew Jackson, he forever changed the way the federal government treated Indians of the previous century. A tragedy of his time is commonly known as the Trail of Tears. It's when the U.S. government, through its cavalry, marched the great nation of Cherokee people from the southwest United States, some of the southeastern United States, to the Midwest, to the Oklahoma area. After Jackson's troops did that, they went back, got the Choctaw people, moved them from Alabama and Georgia, Louisiana, moved them over to Oklahoma. So during Jackson's time, that U.S. government began treating Indians much differently than the previous century. An analogy that I kind of like to draw is that it was a radical change during the time of Jackson. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, President Nixon, the 94th Congress, they've changed the way that Native settlement is going to be handled for the future, for the next century, for the previous century, the way the lands was acted up. Well, gone are those traditional buffers that's normally associated with Native settlements of the past. Ushered in is a new type of Native settlement, and emphasize new. Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is 12 years old. State of Alaska Statehood Act is 20 years old, or 1959 or something. Own corporations are 12, our own corporation is 11 years old. Our regional corporations are 12 years old. Our own city governments, those municipalities which we're supposed to turn land over for, they're only 8 and 9 years old. So we're dealing with a new era of Native settlement, a complex era. Our own Gunayu is only 6 years old. Before I get into the present day situation of where Gunayu is in relation to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I'd like to tell you a couple of stories to give you a feeling of the incredible amount of responsibility that's inflicted upon the present day generation of people who are handling the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Give you a feeling for the responsibilities on a multitude of levels and a number of fashions and different factions. The late Aloysius Tomosky, my wife's grandfather, told me a story one time about the Great Flood. Every culture has a story about a Great Flood. In terms of years, I don't know what we're talking about. I don't recall the story verbatim, but I do recall the value. Says to me, Coy, When the great floodwaters came, when the great floodwaters went down, this Indian woman, she floated in her birchback canoe with her Indian children. He said that canoe came to rest somewhere up where this hill is, this big mountain over here. He said that's where our Indian people began for this area. Now I'm a landsman, and I'm familiar with maps. I've studied this area that Grandpa told me about. The Indian name for the mountain is Hill Coelia. I'd probably murder the name, slaughter the name. Anyway, Hill Coelia feeds through its watershed a majority of those lands north of here, that big basin up, those flatlands. It feeds the Malozzi River. It feeds Bear Creek. It feeds the Dalby River. So I can imagine how over a millennium a people could move from resting place of the old Indian woman's canoe. He also told me another story. Coy, he says, there's a place north of here called Fox Mountain. He said there's a couple holes in the wall, and he made a little gesture like that, and there were holes in the hill. He said, I bet you could find stuff around there. And I know he meant artifacts. Anyway, he told me there's another place at Mueller Mountain. The Army Corps of Engineers came in and blew it up and put it into the dike here. And he also described a place out on the hill that went to the river already. We tend to forget over these past 10 years how we've been treated. Flood of 71, they evacuated the people, the military. They brought our Indian people up to Campion. They separated the men and the women from the boys, put the men and the women inside this enclosure, fenced in enclosure. At 71, it's not very many years ago. I bring that out because that's the point on how government treats Indians. It's not that, it's a lesson that just happened yesterday, so we shouldn't forget them. My point is this. We have roots. We have values, customs, songs, traditions, all things wonderful, which we must protect. When I say me, I mean myself, president, directors of our companies and corporations. I mean you and your report, our public safety officers, our congressmen, our senators, our state government. We all got to be responsible to this Native Claims Settlement Act, all the way down to the individual shareholder. Prior to the consolidation, we're individual village corporations. We spent our first 5 years trying to figure out what the heck we had. Max's explanation of the blind leading the blind. One thing for sure, it was immediate. Immediately after we incorporated, we were given a cash settlement. Collectively, that cash settlement was handled rather poorly. We spent money and invested money and watched over our funds in a manner that was unbecoming a successful business. In 1975, our regional leadership managed to put together Alaska Native Claims Corporation Training Seminar at the University of Alaska. Each of our corporations sent somebody. Peter, he was there. I was there. My wife. People on the board. Billy, he was on the board that time. Patty over there, he's helping out. We're all trying to figure out what the heck we had. It was at that training seminar that my eyes were open and I caught a glimpse of what this Native Claims Settlement Act meant. It's also in 1975 that the state of Alaska sent each of our village corporations a notice saying they were going to dissolve our corporations because we didn't pay a $50 filing fee, a corporate filing fee. From what we learned from the University of Alaska, the consolidation over at MTNT, the McGrath area, and the state's single act of threatening to dissolve us propelled us into talking about consolidating with that single act. So there we were, going backwards, additional pressures being felt by the operation of state and corporate law to very early indications of exactly how fragile this Claim Settlement Act was and is. To make a long story short, we consolidated in 1978 into Gunnedah Limited. Economically, we're kind of back on an even keel, and we're maturing as a Native corporation. And this rest of this speech, I'm going to scrap and ad lib. From the testimony that I've heard here this morning, there seems to be, I kind of want to put it in perspective. What Charlie Evans is talking about is from the time of Jackson to the time of the Land Claims Act, it was his work through the village that got us our land and how we operate in the village. He went out there and he marked a bunch of land. And then the government came by and they granted the Native villages land through public land orders. Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act came by in 71 and revoked all those public landowners, immediately wiped out what he'd spent a lifetime doing. He's told us of some old records. We're looking for them. We hope we find them. We don't know what they mean. The recording office burned down in Ruby. We're searching in the BIA and the BLM, and we finally got the BLM to look in their real old records. Within the Gunnedah youth structure, our land department has a full-time staff and has had for 2.5 years. So in a way, from the consolidation, we were kind of just maturing and hanging on until 2.5 years ago when we decided to put more money into our land base and figure out what we had here. To date, we've received over 90% of our entitlements through interim conveyance. Maybe we got patent to about 2 or 3 acres of land. Of those lands we received, fully 1/4 of our settlement is without protections. Without those protections that are offered in the Alaska National Lands Conservation Act, or the Deep Two Bill, as commonly known to us. Protections against adverse possession, that's gone. Protections against taxes and assessments, they're no longer there on the land. Protections against judgments or any action in law or in equity to recover sums of money that we might owe to someone, or penalties that we might incur. They can go after our land. That's how fragile this thing is. There's lots of outside forces attacking our settlement. Individuals, municipalities, state and federal governments. They're exerting a significant amount of pressures on the Native settlement. We have 437,760 acres, or 684 square miles of land. This equates roughly into 65% of the land mass of the state of Rhode Island. It's It's an incredible amount of land, which equates into an awesome job and an awesome amount of responsibilities for a board of directors and their staff employees. The reality of the settlement is that we're a small company with a large land base. The Claims Act has provisions. To give you an example of the pressures, the Claims Act has provisions to turn land over to the municipalities. All of our municipalities became municipalities after the Land Claims Act. That was the one single thing of real cap during those early years, was incorporate the villages and the cities. They came by and did it. Thus, we have to turn them over 1,280 acres. This, having to turn land over the cities, was subsequently amended to allow for less than 1,280 acres. The process for 14C in the state of Alaska was started right here in Galena. We were the very first agreement. The amendment didn't come until years later. There are times when I wish we could reverse the process, because it took away from our corporate native settlement. The 14C process stripped us of an opportunity to develop a land base in each village, a foundation in each of the communities. In 1980, there was an amendment to the amount of acres that we could give the municipalities. And in Caltag, the municipal government chose to select less than 1,280 acres. They selected 550, in fact. This was a significant step for Gunnayu Limited and our settlement, the shareholders of Caltag and the shareholders all over. It created for us new opportunities in which to form and mold this settlement. For the life of me, I can't see why we want to take our land and give it to a city government so the city government can turn around and take money that's fueled by the state, fueled by those land sales, and by other means, and in effect, outstrip us of the opportunity. We see it right here happening in Galena. We made a vow that we'd try our darndest to convince the shareholders in other villages to go for less, and we're still working at that. It kind of puts us in a little dilemma whenever we give these cities. So first we had the Land Claims Act, it was our settlement, then we have to give land to the cities, and the cities in turn give lands to third parties, and this whole big process starts of where it becomes, falls out of control, out of native control. Stymies the opportunity for the corporation. And the funny thing about it is that after we give them the land, they dispose of it all, give it to third parties, and they create all these services, water and sewer and all these good things. They sell all their land, they have no more cash base, which would generate that income as they're doing now. Then they're going to have to turn to taxing our land. And we're not safe from taxes. We only have 18 more years. In 18 more years, our land base is going to be gone. So they're going to go after our land, and it'll happen. Unless, of course, we can devise means of which to give us an equal footing, sort of an equal footing doctrine of our own. Subsistence. Our whole settlement, or all of our land thing, was selected for its subsistence value. We didn't select it for timber or gold, anything like that. We selected it for the subsistence. We don't have any commercial amount of timber where we can get in some operation. It just doesn't exist. When we go get logs, you pick one straight log here, move down the river and pick another one and another one. Big forests of them don't exist. We're trying to protect subsistence through a provision in the D2 bill called the Alaska Land Bank Program. We're having trouble even negotiating that agreement because, one, we've been told that this new Alaska land claims is an opportunity for you to be in private business and take off and go off into the future. When you go back and deal with government and try to get them to enact some of the provisions of these bills, they're kind of reluctant and treat us as if we were Indians of the past century and treat our settlement of Indians of the past century. Puts us in a very, it puts us into a catch-22 situation. I want to answer Mac's question on employment. I realize he kind of beat around the bush. But we do offer employment in a limited number. We have a store here which employs 2 people, and we have a land department that has 3 people and an office staff of 4 people, and then of Max and our general manager, or 3 people and Max and our general manager. We also have fuel depots in each of the villages supplies a necessity. We don't make any money off it, and it employs a couple of people on a part-time basis. I also wanted to explain Max's thing again on land, on the price of land and when it took place. In 1978 was when the city had their first sale of land, and that was 3 cents a square foot. Last year, at the last land sale, it was selling for an average of 32 cents a square foot. That's an incredible jump. By us not having the opportunity by which to provide something for our shareholders, shareholder leases,